Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Isaiah chapter 40, which I will entitle The Greatness of God. We're now in that section of Isaiah, which all the commentators unanimously say is the greatest part of the book and maybe even the greatest part of the Old Testament. Prophecies now will turn away from historical things such as Sennacherib of Assyria and turn toward prophecies about the coming of the gospel. We start now in Isaiah 40, verses 1 through 5. Isaiah begins, "Comfort, comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and proclaim to her that her hard service has been completed, that her sin has been paid for, that she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. A voice of one calling, in the desert prepare the way for the Lord. Make straight in the wilderness a highway for our God. Every valley shall be raised up, every mountain and hill made low. The rough ground shall become level, the rugged places a plain. And the glory of the Lord will be revealed, and all mankind together will see it. For the mouth of the Lord has spoken." Now, a little introduction here. First of all, as always, we need to decide to which period of time the prophecy points. Option number one, the Babylonian captivity. Option number two, the times of Jesus. Option number three, the Babylonian captivity as a type of the times of Jesus. I'm going to take option three. Now, to give you a feel, as sort of an introduction to this chapter, I'm going to read from six commentators. Here's Barnes. "It is admitted on all hands that the second part of Isaiah, comprising the prophecies which commence at the 40th chapter and which continue to the end of the book, is to be regarded as the most sublime and to us the most important part of the Old Testament. In the previous portions of his prophecies, there was much that was local and temporary. For example, Sennacherib and Assyria and so forth. Here's Adam Clark. In this chapter, the prophet opens the subject respecting the restoration of the church with great force and elegance, declaring God's command to his messengers, the prophets, to comfort his people in their captivity and to impart to them the glad tidings that the time of favor and deliverance was at hand. So Clark mentions the delivery from Babylon, the return from the exile, as what Isaiah is referring to. Barnes, in that previous quote I gave you, Barnes believes it refers to more permanent things, times of the Messiah. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says this, "The former prophecies were local and temporary in their reference. These belong to the distant future and are worldwide in their interest. The deliverance from Babylon under Cyrus, which he here foretells by prophetic suggestion, carries him on to the greater deliverance under Messiah, the Savior of Jews and Gentiles in the present eclectic church." He means the church that has Jews and Gentiles in it. "And the restorer of Israel and head of the worldwide kingdom, literal and spiritual, ultimately." So Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown go from the return from Babylon, 538 or so, to the times of Jesus, all the way to the end of the world. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown continue, "As Assyria was the hostile world power in the former part, which refers to Isaiah's own time, so Babylon is so in the latter part, which refers to a period long subsequent," which is fancy language to say that Isaiah is talking about the Babylonian captivity, and he's also talking about the times of Jesus the Messiah. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown also say in another place, "The scene is laid in Babylon, the time near the close of the captivity. The ground of comfort is the speedy ending of the captivity, the Lord himself being their leader." So Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that not only is Isaiah prophesying about the times of the Messiah, but also he is prophesying about the return from the Babylonian exiles effected by the Jews in 538 or so B.C. Now here's what Adam Clark says. "The course of prophecies which follow, from hence to the end of the book, and which taken together constitute the most elegant part of the sacred writings of the Old Testament, interspersed also with many passages of the highest sublimity, was probably delivered in the latter part of the reign of Hezekiah." Hezekiah died in 687 B.C. "The prophet in the foregoing chapter had delivered a very explicit declaration of the impending dissolution of the kingdom and of the captivity of the royal house of David and of the people under the kings of Babylon, as the subject of his subsequent prophecies was to be chiefly of the consolatory kind. He opens them with giving a promise of the restoration of the kingdom and the return of the people from that captivity by the merciful interposition of God in their favor. But the views of the prophet are not confined to this event. As the restoration of the royal family and of the tribe of Judah, which would otherwise have soon become undistinguished and have become irrevocably lost, was necessary in the design and order of providence for the fulfilling of God's promises of establishing a more glorious and an everlasting kingdom under the Messiah to be born of the tribe of Judah and of the family of David the prophet, connects these two events together, and hardly ever treats of the former without throwing in some intimations of the latter, and sometimes is so fully possessed with the glories of the future and more remote kingdom that he seems to leave the more immediate subject of his commission almost out of the question. Well, once again, Clark is saying in very flowery language is that Isaiah is talking about the return from Babylon, 537, whenever it was, right around there. And he's also talking about the times of the Messiah. Clark goes on to say in another place, indeed, this evangelical sense of the prophecy is so apparent and stands forth in so strong a light that some interpreters cannot see that it has any other and will not allow the prophecy to have any relation at all to the return from the captivity of Babylon. Well, we're not going to go that far. We're going to take them both. Return from Babylon and also the flocking of the Gentiles and the Jews into the kingdom of Christ in the times of Jesus. Isaiah says in verse 2, speak tenderly to Jerusalem and proclaim to her that her hard service has been completed. The hard service being the exile to Babylon. Started in 586, ended in 538 or 37. Now, some say that these verses do not only apply to the destruction by Babylon in 586, because verse 2 says her hard service has been completed and Jerusalem still had some more hard service to pay. For example, the invasion of Jerusalem by Antiochus Epiphanes in 168 or so when he defiled the temple. And of course, when the Romans burnt down the city in AD 70. But I think that's not legitimate. Isaiah could just be saying, the times of your hard service, Jerusalem in Babylon, has been completed. And then Isaiah is not making a statement about what comes next. It just means the Babylonian exile has been completed, not the overall tribulations of Jerusalem have been completed. Her sin has been paid for. She has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. Now we have a problem in verse 2. What does it mean that Jerusalem had been paid double? Option number 1, the justice that Jerusalem received was worth twice what the sin was that Jerusalem had committed. The problem is how is that just? If God pays you back twice, that means that you're suffering a double punishment and there's no equity there. This verse is quoted in Revelation 18:6, when Babylon the Great, which I believe to be apostate Israel, is referred to, and John says, pay apostate Israel back the way she also paid, and double it according to her works. In the cup in which she mixed, mix a double portion for her. Well, I don't think that Isaiah is strictly talking about eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth here. I think he means that the judgment is just going to be terrible. Double. A lot. Option number 2 as to what this double means. This option says that it means the two captivities and emigrations suffered by the Israelites. Now, which two captivities? Well, it could be the Assyrian captivity of northern Israel in 722 and the Babylonian captivity of southern Israel, Judah, in 586. Clark and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown suggest it's the two captivities carried out by the Babylonians in 586 and the Romans in 70 AD. I don't think double refers to the two captivities. I can't prove it, but it doesn't sound right to me. Option number 3, it shouldn't be double payment. It should be double blessings. It shouldn't be double punishment. It should be double blessings. Let's read it that way. She has received from the Lord's hand double blessings for all her sins. In other words, God is gracious. Now, Clark and Benson hold to this view. Clark says this, to express this sense of the passage, which the words of the original will very well bear, it was necessary to add a word or two in the version, that's the King James, to supply the elliptical expression of the Hebrew. In other words, if you just put blessing after double, you'll have it. She has received from the Lord's hand double blessing for all her sins. I am not exactly sure which option is the best one, so I'll report that one and let you decide. And now in verse 3, Isaiah says, a voice of one calling, in the desert prepare the way for the Lord. Well, that sounds familiar, I'm sure. That sounds like John the Baptist. And as a matter of fact, that's who Isaiah must have been referring to, a voice of one calling. That's John the Baptist. In the desert prepare the way for the Lord, make straight in the wilderness a highway for our God. And of course, the highway is so that people may come into the kingdom without a lot of trouble. no valleys, no deep crevices in the road, because the valleys are raised up, filled in, so the road's flat, every mountain and hill made low, so that the penitent does not have to wander around hills and mountains trying to get into the kingdom. The rough ground shall become level or smooth. The rugged place is a plain, smooth, flat. It's easy to get into the kingdom now through the blood of Jesus. Now, those verses, of course, sound very familiar. In John 1:23, we read, He said, I am the voice of one crying out in the wilderness. That's John the Baptist said that. Make straight the way of the Lord, just as Isaiah the prophet said. So John the Baptist refers back to Isaiah. He must have been familiar with Isaiah, and he quotes verse 3. Now in Luke chapter 3, verses 5 and 6, we read this. Every valley will be filled, and every mountain and hill will be made low. The crooked will become straight, the rough ways smooth, and everyone will see the salvation of God. That is essentially a quotation of verses 3 and 4 of Isaiah 40. The salvation of God is added by Luke. He knew what Isaiah meant. This straight and level road is the highway of salvation coming into the kingdom. Verse 5, and the glory of the Lord will be revealed in Isaiah 40, and all mankind together will see it. And all mankind means all Jews and all Gentiles. Why? For the mouth of the Lord has spoken. When he speaks, it happens. We go now to Isaiah 40, verses 6 through 8. A voice says, Cry out. And I said, What shall I cry? This is Isaiah said. Isaiah said, What shall I cry? And this is the answer. This is what it should cry. All men are like grass, and all their glory is like the flowers of the field. The grass withers and the flowers fall, because the breath of the Lord blows on them. Surely the people are grass. The grass withers and the flowers fall, but the word of our God stands forever. Now this voice in verse 6 that cried out is the same voice of the herald in verse 3. And I said that voice of the one calling was John the Baptist, the one prophesied about. And so John the Baptist again says, What shall I cry? Or at least it's the voice in Isaiah's vision who says, What shall I cry? All men are like grass. Now, what does that mean? All men are like grass. This is what Adam Clark says. What is this but a plain opposition of the flesh to the spirit, of the carnal Israel to the spiritual, of the temporary Mosaic economy to the eternal Christian dispensation? You may be ready to conclude, the prophet may be disposed to say, by this introduction to my discourse, that my commission is only to comfort you with a promise of the restoration of your religion and polity, of Jerusalem, of the temple and its services and worship and all its ancient splendor. These are earthly, temporary, shadowy, fading things, which shall soon pass away and be destroyed forever. These are not worthy to engage your attention in comparison of the greater blessings, the spiritual redemption, the eternal inheritance covered under the veil of the former, which I have it in charge to unfold unto you. So Adam Clark, in a prolix 19th century way, has said that John the Baptist is saying the old is going to go down, the new, the kingdom of the Messiah is coming. Now, upon reading Clark, I had a little trouble thinking that Isaiah really meant that the men who were like grass were the Jews of the Old Testament Mosaic order that was getting ready to pass away. However, we see Peter in 1 Peter 1, verses 24 and 25, quote this passage of Isaiah, and Peter directly connects Isaiah's quote with the gospel. We read in 1 Peter 1, verses 24 and 25, All flesh is as grass, and all the glory of man as the flower of grass. The grass withers, and the flower falls off, but the word of the Lord endures forever. And this is the word which by the gospel is preached unto you. So Peter says, All flesh is grass. And then he says, This is the word which by the gospel is preached unto you. The word that endures forever, as opposed to the flesh that is like grass and withers away. So that makes a pretty strong case that Isaiah is prophesying the end of the old covenant and the beginning of the new covenant. In verse 7, the grass withers and the flowers fall because the breath of the Lord blows on those flowers. That's the withering east wind that God sends upon the flowers off the desert to the east. We go now to Isaiah chapter 40, verses 9 through 11. Isaiah continues, You who bring good tidings to Zion, go up on a high mountain. You who bring good tidings to Jerusalem, lift up your voice with a shout. Lift it up. Do not be afraid. Say to the towns of Judah, Here is your God. See, the sovereign Lord comes with power, and his arm rules for him. See, his reward is with him, and his recompense accompanies him. He tends his flock like a shepherd. He gathers the lambs in his arms and carries them close to his heart. He gently leads those that have young. Verse 9, Isaiah says, "You who bring good tidings to Zion," some unnamed messenger who's bringing some good news to Jerusalem. Zion is in parallel with Jerusalem. Zion is a common metaphor for Jerusalem, the part for the whole. Mount Zion is the part. Jerusalem is the whole. What good tidings is this messenger bringing? He's bringing news of deliverance from the Babylonian exile to Jerusalem. Deliverance coming out of Babylon. The exiles are returning. And of course, we've already said that in our view, this prophecy, this chapter refers to the exiles returning from Babylon as a type of all of the Gentiles and Jews coming into the kingdom of God in the new Zion, the church of Jesus Christ. As John Gill says, this verse, this good tidings, is a type of Christ bringing good news to believers, the good news of the gospel. Now, the NIV has it that the messenger is bringing good tidings to Zion, but other translations have Zion is publishing the good news, not receiving the good news. For example, the Holman Christian Study Bible says, "Zion, herald of good news, go up on a high mountain. Jerusalem, herald of good news, raise your voice." That doesn't really affect the meaning too much. Most of the translations go along with the Holman Christian Study Bible, KJV, Darby, God's World, KJV, Darby, God's Word, New American Bible, New American Standard Bible, Young's Literal Translation. It's Jerusalem publishing the good news. But the whole point is that people are going to be coming into the church, and that's good news, and they're going to be coming back from Babylon, and that's the type of the good news. In verse 10, Isaiah says, "See, the sovereign Lord comes with power." What kind of coming? The second coming? Most probably not. But it could be John the Baptist. Remember in verse 3, Isaiah referred to a voice calling in the desert, "Prepare the way for the Lord, make straight in the wilderness a highway for our God. Every valley shall be raised up, every mountain and hill shall be made low, the rough ground shall become level." That, of course, is a direct quote from John the Baptist, as we've already said in John 1 and Luke 3. So in verse 10, when Isaiah says, "See, the sovereign Lord comes with power," this is probably the coming of John the Baptist, who comes to announce good news of the coming king. Well, that's option number two. Option number three is the coming with power is Jesus coming at his first coming. He's coming with power to destroy sin. As John Gill says, his work required, which was to fulfill the law, satisfy divine justice, atone for sin, grapple in conflict with innumerable enemies, undergo the death of the cross, bear the curse of the law and the wrath of God, and all in order to obtain eternal redemption for his people. And of course, Jesus came with power to do miracles also, and his arm rules for him. Well, I think of these two options, John the Baptist, God coming through the agency of John the Baptist, or rather it's Jesus himself coming with power. I think the latter is the better option. It's Jesus coming with power. Because we see at the end of verse 10, "See, his reward is with him." Well, Jesus has a reward, salvation. His recompense accompanies him, salvation. In verse 11, "He tends his flock like a shepherd." Well, who was the good shepherd? That was Jesus. "He gathers the lambs in his arms and carries them close to his heart." That was Jesus. "He gently leads those that have young," the sheep that have young sheep. He leads them. This is, in my humble opinion, a prophecy of Jesus coming to take care of his flock. We go now to Isaiah 40, verses 12 through 14. Isaiah continues, "Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, or with the breadth of his hand, and marked off the heavens? Who has held the dust of the earth in a basket, or weighed the mountains on the scales and the hills in a balance? Who has understood the mind of the Lord, or instructed him as his counselor? Whom did the Lord consult to enlighten him, and who taught him the right way? Who was it that taught him knowledge or showed him the path of understanding?" These, of course, are a series of rhetorical questions, the answer to which is nobody. Nobody has done this. Now, whether it's God, who Isaiah is looking for as the person who has done all these miraculous things, or whether it's Jesus, can be debated. I believe it's probably just referring to God. I don't know how much you can say that Isaiah is looking forward to the Messiah. I think he's talking about God here. Now, notice all the things that are being done are big. Measured all the waters on the earth in one hand? The contrast is striking. Marked off all the heavens with the breadth of his hand? The heavens are mighty big to be measuring the heavens with the width of one's hand. Held all the dust of the earth in one little basket? Tremendous contrast. Weighed the mountains on a little pair of scales? That's the same thing as saying that a human mind, in verse 13, has understood the mind of the Lord. Well, obviously not. Who's instructed God? Who can give God advice? Nobody. Did God ever consult anybody to give him some enlightenment? Did God ever consult anybody to teach him which way God should go? Who was it? Nobody. Now, what work of God is being referred to here? John Gill says it's the great work of salvation. Some people have said it's the deliverance from Babylon. Some people say it's creation when he created the world. Could be all of the above. But I think more particularly, he's talking about the return from Babylon, which is a type of the church coming into the new Zion, the new Jerusalem. We go now to Isaiah 40, verses 15 through 17. Surely the nations are like a drop in a bucket. They are regarded as dust on the scales. He weighs the islands as though they were fine dust. Lebanon is not sufficient for altar fires, nor its animals enough for burnt offerings. Before him all the nations are as nothing. They are regarded by him as worthless and less than nothing. Dust on the scales. That doesn't move the scales too much. The dust doesn't weigh very much. Nobody ever brushes off the scales when they measure something to see how heavy it is. And a drop in a bucket, if you slosh one little drop out of a bucket, who cares? That's what the nations are like to God. They're nothing. He weighs the islands as though they were fine dust. Of course, the islands in the Mediterranean Sea are everywhere. You can start with Cyprus, go to Crete, go to the Aegean Islands. Then you can go to Corsica on the other side, the western side of Greece. I don't know if there are islands in the Adriatic Sea. I'm sure they are. But then if you go to the western side of Italy, you've got the big islands, Corsica to the north and Sardinia to the south. You go a little bit further to the west, you've got the Balearic Islands off the eastern shore of Spain. There are islands everywhere. But it's just like little fine grains of dust to God. He doesn't care. They're nothing. And verse 16, Lebanon is not sufficient for altar fires. In other words, you're going to set up a fire on God's altar. His altar is so big that you can chop down all the cedar trees in Lebanon and burn them, and it's going to look like a little flicker. You can take all the animals running around in those forests and offer them for burnt offerings. Nothing. Not sufficient. Not enough for God. Isaiah is not only a great prophet, he's a great writer too. Great hyperbole here. We go down to Isaiah 40, verses 18 through 20. Isaiah continues, "To whom then will you compare God? What image will you compare him to? As for an idol, a craftsman casts it, and a goldsmith overlays it with gold and fashions silver chains for it. A man too poor to present such an offering selects wood that will not rot. He looks for a skilled craftsman to set up an idol that will not topple." Well, once again, Isaiah mocks idols as the Old Testament prophets are wont to do. Of course, God can't be compared to an idol. It's absurd that people would worship an idol rather than the true God. The goldsmith makes the idol, overlays it with gold, and makes silver chains for the idol. Well, what are the chains for? Well, it could be for decoration, or it could be for support, to fasten the idol to some wall or pillar, as John Gill says, that it may stand upright and may not be taken down and stole away, or blown down with the wind, or fall of itself and be broken. In other words, the idol is so weak it's got to have a chain to hold him up, or a puff of wind might knock him over. In verse 20, Isaiah shows that idolatry is not limited to rich people, but poor people themselves love to present idols. They can't afford the gold and silver, but they'll find some wood. They'll find the best wood they can that won't rot. Then they'll find a craftsman to carve it up, to set up an idol that will not topple. That's a problem, because idols tend to fall over. We go down to Isaiah 40, verses 21 through 24. Isaiah continues, "Do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood since the earth was founded? He sits enthroned above the circle of the earth, and its people are like grasshoppers. He stretches out the heavens like a canopy and spreads them out like a tent to live in. He brings princes to naught and reduces the rulers of this world to nothing. No sooner are they planted, no sooner are they sown, no sooner do they take root in the ground, than he blows on them and they wither, and a whirlwind sweeps them away like chaff." What was been told to the people of Judah from the beginning, as Isaiah says in verse 21? John Gill says, from the beginning of your state and kingdom, from the beginning of the world, by the wisest and best of men, they have been in it. So the beginning, I think it's probably from the beginning of the world, speaking hyperbolically, since they weren't there when the world was founded. But from the beginning, and then the next part of verse 21 says, have you not understood since the earth was founded? So that sounds like Hebrew parallelism to me. So the beginning is when the earth was founded. In other words, the news has been out about God for a long time. You should have been listening. In verse 22, God sits on his throne. And where is that throne? Above the circle of the earth. Why is it the circle of the earth? Because the earth is a globe. For all of you who think that the Old Testament ancient people thought that the earth was flat, that seems to be a myth. I know they didn't think that in the Middle Ages. We all think they did. Common opinion, popular opinion. No, they knew that the world was a globe. And of course, the ancient Greek philosophers also, or many of them at least, said that the world was a globe. And here Isaiah says that the world is round and not flat. But the point is not that, of course. The point is God is so high up in the air that when he looks down, the people of the earth are like grasshoppers. He's not worried about grasshoppers. He stretches out the heavens like a canopy. If you think about the blue sky, it's a canopy over the earth, and they have to be unrolled, stretched out, like a tent. He brings princes to naught and reduces the rulers of this world to nothing. Oh, I wish he would do that to our current princes and rulers of this world. I wish that as soon as they take root in the ground and take up their offices in Washington, D.C., that God would blow on them and that they would wither and that a whirlwind would sweep them away like chaff. But I don't know what God's plan is. If he doesn't do that, I guess we'll have to suffer. We go now to Isaiah 40, verses 25 through 31. Isaiah continues, and now he's speaking for God. He says, God says, to whom will you compare me? Or who is my equal? Says the Holy One. That's God. Lift your eyes and look to the heavens. Who created all these? He who brings out the starry host one by one and calls them each by name. Because of his great power and mighty strength, not one of them is missing. Why do you say, O Jacob, and complain, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, my cause is disregarded by my God? Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He will not grow tired or weary, and his understanding no one can fathom. He gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Even youths grow tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. Now in verse 25, Isaiah says, or God says, to whom will you compare me? Well, that's the same thing God said in verse 18 of this chapter. Who will you compare God with? What likeness will you compare him to? Well, obviously, there's no one to compare to God. Who is my equal? Rhetorical question, the answer to which is nobody. And how do you know that? Because you can look up at the heavens and see that he created all the starry host. All the stars, he names every star. We can't even count them. He names them. Not one of them is missing from his eyes as he goes up into the depths of outer space and counts every star and names every star. In verse 27, Isaiah says, hey, Jacob, which is Israel, Judah, why do you say and complain, my way is hidden from the Lord? Well, the reason they were complaining was because they were in captivity in Babylon and they were griping that God was not listening to them in their distress. God answers that. God is everlasting. He made the earth. He's not tired. He's not weary. He understands things that nobody else can understand. No one can fathom his wisdom. And you don't understand why he hasn't delivered you from Babylon, but God knows. And in verse 29, God will give strength to the weary, all of you Judahites who are in Babylon. God will give strength to you. He will increase the power of you weak people. Even young men who are strong, they get tired and weary. Young men, even they who walk straight, they'll stumble and fall. But if you hope in the Lord, you will renew your strength. And God will give you the ability to endure the rest of the captivity, which will not go on forever. It might be a lot longer than you want, but God will renew your strength. You're going to fly like an eagle. You're going to run and not be weary, walk and not faint. So that's the good news. And that's the end of this chapter. And we've finished on a high note here. And we are now prepared to go to Isaiah chapter 41, which I will entitle, Fear Not, For I Am With You. So now Isaiah has gone from judgment, gloom, and doom, and now he's going to consolation and comfort. So I hope you stay tuned for the next audio in this series, and I hope you enjoyed this one.